So, Javier, you've been very interested in focusing, better understanding violence, preventing it.
Hello, Serge. Yes, I've been working in child protection for over a decade, and first I started with more cognitive approaches or human rights approaches, children's rights approach. And slowly I got to see that there was something missing when we train people, when we train professionals, when we train families, when we listen to children about their own violence. There was something that was missing. So I knew some methodologies that were experiential, and at the same time, there was something else, something that could be discovered, added.
So in a way we get into that dot 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 area, that little something that's hard to put a name onto, and obviously that's where focusing comes in.
Yes, and so when I started learning focusing, I had already had my training as a psychologist. I had been working in Morocco and Mauritania in child protection, and also here in Spain with at-risk youth, teenagers and young people. And I had also been involved with nonviolent communication, and focusing was something like the missing key, the way to make people, adults, professionals, parents, supervisors, psychotherapists, but also children, teenagers, to go deep inside and find why something was violence.
So maybe something where, as you were talking about before, there is a limit to, you know, cognitive tools. And the idea that with focusing, you know, people are able to touch on the moment, where it's just about to happen, before it's fully out.
Yes. It is quite a challenge, because when working, for example, with professionals, I sometimes have a very big team of professionals in child protection, for example, that know each other, that somebody else's boss or something like that. So people come there in a very protected way, like, tell me new tools that I'm going to use, using only my head, only my cognitive skills. So the way is introducing it, of course, with a little bit of cognitive and going slowly into the experiential. Because if not, I've had some experiences of taking much longer to go deep. So a little bit of cognitive, and the best way that I've found to deal with violence in grown-ups is going to their own childhood. We live, whatever society we live in, I've been in Asia, I've been in some parts of Africa, I speak fluent Moroccan Arabic, so I know the culture, and there are differences, and at the same time, we've all felt that thing that when we are children, we know that it harms us, that it causes us pain, that it shouldn't be happening. It's a little bit like what Jenlin says about the stopped process, violence, I understand that it is a kind of stopped process. Something else should have happened, but didn't.
Yeah. So something about, thinking about violence as a stopped process, but not, in an abstract way. Just that you've noticed time and again that actually, despite the differences between cultures, the common point is something that happened or didn't happen or was not completed in childhood that has to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that doesn't have to be traumatic. Sometimes it is the continuous experience of that stoppage, that stopped process. So these are two of the key ingredients, two of the key cognitive ingredients. The first one is harm. Something should have happened in another way, and it didn't. And that stops a natural process. For example, a child is singing, is playing, and a parent is tired and shouts at them. Then there is that harm of, maybe they don't mind. The children sometimes take it, okay, I don't mind. But depending on the way, depending on the moment, depending on the when, depending on a lot of circumstances, the child can interpret that as, I'm not acceptable. I'm not acceptable with my whole. I'm not acceptable with my happiness. Or the opposite. In some other situations, children, boys, should not cry. Good girls should not get angry. So there are parts, there are natural processes that are evolving, that are appearing, and those are shut down.
Yeah.
And what does the kid do with that?
Yeah. So you get to essentially an experience where something was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
As if little boy shouldn't have tears. Mm-hmm. Little girl shouldn't be angry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that is so pervasive that in a way people are not very aware of it, and yet it continues to affect them.
Mm-hmm. When we go to bigger or more severe cases of violence, it is more evident. So, for example, we can agree that spanking a child is not in the benefit. It causes harm. Now there are lots of studies, biological, neurological, pharmacological studies that show why hitting somebody else causes them harm.
Yeah.
So there we can see that something else should be happening and it isn't. And there's something happening there, a stopping, that doesn't receive a listening, an acknowledgement from a trusted person, so that the child, so as we, as children, can acknowledge, oh, and this is not my fault. This is not, that is something in me is bad. This is just somebody's upset, somebody's tired, somebody doesn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. So very powerful as you see the genesis of this, as this is something that's troubling, that has not received that empathetic listening, so mm-hmm. that the child is not able to digest it and realize, hey, this is not my fault. This is not me. This is the other person, and the other person had, you know, did it for this or that reason, but, you know, is able to actually go beyond it, and instead, they don't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is important is that if this happens only once in a lifetime, it is not going to leave a mark. Mm-hmm. But if it happens continuously, because this is the culture, we are at a certain level of evolution, we have developed in some ways, but there are other ways that are still to be explored. We cannot see when we become grown-ups, we see violence as something natural. Causing harm to somebody because they have caused harm to us is acceptable. Somebody shouts at us, it is okay to shout back at them. If somebody does behaves in a way that we don't like, we try to make them feel bad. So it is a kind of culture that we are immersed in. It is part of our environment. It could be understood in Gendlin's terms in a process model as a pattern. This is a correct way of behaving. And we cannot see that causing harm is violence.
Mm-hmm. And so you're outlining how the individual experience can turn into a pattern and a culture of violence.
Mm-hmm. And also how violence is patterned. When we go abroad to other cultures, we can see something like, we can identify something as very violent in our culture. In our cultures, in other cultures, for example, in many cultures in Africa, when you greet somebody, you just look down as a way of respect. When they come, for example, here to Spain, some people get upset as they are disrespecting me because they're not looking at me. Mm-hmm. No, they are respecting in their culture. You are interpreting that. Or, for example, in other cultures, where just rising a little bit the tone of voice would be seen as something very rude. In other cultures, it's a way of getting in a playfulness. So, you know, the Mediterranean style of shouting and greeting in other countries is seen like, oh my gosh, what's this? They are rude, they are not being polite. So, and also with other kinds of interpersonal violence. For example, now in many places and in many cultural situations, we are aware about gender-based violence. And when we confront, for example, our elders, I mean, some people are like, no, but women should, but men should. And it's like, okay, that was something like 50 years ago. We are now in 2016, things have changed. Women and men can do the same things, have the same rights, or at least should have. There's a long way to go there. But so we can see that violence is just something more pervasive. And it is there where having a handle for violence is so important.
Yeah. So that sense of, how, in a way, it could be pervasive, it could be hidden in the culture, and mm-hmm. And that prevents, you know, dealing with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because most of the violence is not intentional. I mean, it is intentional acts, but not intentional violence. When, for example, in a couple, when somebody, they're in a party and one of the partners in a couple looks at the other, it's in a certain way, and the other says, okay, we go home, in a sad tone, that has been violence. The person is feeling something has been harmed there. So it is very important to have the concept of harm, but also important to have an inner feeling of when something is harming you. And there is where focusing can be brought in.
And so you're dealing in an exquisite way with these nuances, with the subtleties of the moment. And you see the harm and you see the consciousness of the moment when something is harming you. So that having that consciousness, you know, then it becomes a mindful, intentional action as opposed to a knee-jerk reaction. And the knee-jerk reaction is usually something that is condoned by a lifetime of experience and often the culture itself, and goes into violence, as opposed to having that moment where it's possible to actually shift gears.
And it is fascinating. I remember myself when I started receiving trainings on violence and then learning focusing and getting deeper and deeper and starting to see that, oh, this person, what they have done, it's violence. And even more, oh, myself, what I have done, even if I didn't intend to, this has been violence. So it is really, and in workshops, it's really fantastic, especially if there is some time in between. People come then, after some hours of training and they came to the rest of the training and they are like, oh, I couldn't believe how violent I was at home. I couldn't believe that I was going to tell my partner, my spouse, my children, this and that. And I was silent the whole afternoon or the whole night. Or I just said that and then I felt so bad. And I kept telling myself, and it's like, oh, can you see the violence against yourself too? So there's kind of also violence to others, violence that we receive from others, and violence we exert against parts of ourselves. So, again, yes.
I really am very appreciative as you talk of how it's all in that subtle, paying attention to the subtle nuances in the gray areas. And it's certainly the exact opposite of if we're dealing with violence, it's because, oh, I am good, I'm not a violent person, and you are, you know, this violent person, and I better teach you how to not be. But it's about understanding in a way how violence is pervasive, how it is very much part of ourselves, and being able in that place, you know, understanding the subtleties and the gray areas, in a way, dealing from as a peer to peer instead of from a one-up position.
Certainly. And one of the most important things that for me to convey in a training or in therapy or in other situations is we all are violent. We all commit acts of violence. The problem is not committing them. The problem is being aware, catching ourselves and being able to stop, to ask for forgiveness, to repair the situation. Because when we speak about violence, people think, even professionals think about, oh, violence is when a husband beats down his wife and sends her to the hospital. And it is no. That is a very high point of violence. Of course it is violence, but nobody wakes up a morning and says, what am I going to do today? Oh, I think I'm going to beat my spouse. It has been a long trek, a long journey from starting like looking bad at this person, then disrespecting them, telling them you're not valuable, then insulting them, then maybe grasping them, then maybe hitting, and then, I'm sorry, it's not so bad. If you hadn't done that, I wouldn't have had to guilting them, making them guilty, feel guilty about something. So it's a long trek, and if we are at the beginning of the trek, we can always go backwards. So if we look bad at somebody, we can always say, I'm sorry, I was very upset at that. When you said that, I felt terribly angry, and I shouldn't have looked at you. So there is this awareness, and this awareness is also in the body. We can teach ourselves with some focusing and focusing exercises for people who do not know or do not have a focusing training. We can train ourselves to see, there is this something that is coming here that feels like I'm going to get angry, or the opposite. I'm feeling here something that is like my alarm that there's some violence around that I'm not cognitively understanding, but feeling inside.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, yeah. And as you said, at the beginning, you know, of that long process, of that long continuum, where it's not so reinforced by years and years of self-reinforcing experience. It's easier to turn back, or at the outset of the moment of anger, it's easier to deal with than when you're in the full force of it. And so, mm-hmm. in one case, you know, the approach is to get people to be more understanding of the moment where it's about to happen, as opposed to when you're in the full force of it.
I agree with that. And also, for example, with teenagers,
mm-hmm.
in my experience working with them, sometimes it is easier when they're really upset, and you can, when we have worked with them for some time, and then we can say, you see, there, you're terribly angry. Aren't you? Yes, I am. Okay. Let's see what it is like. So, for example, with teenagers, it doesn't work with nuances. It works when they're really angry, when they're really upset, when they're, so it's not, it can be tailored to whoever comes to our situation. Mm-hmm, it's just, mm-hmm. how is this situation being for you?
But so, yeah, so let's go back into, say, for instance, right now we're talking about, say, the teenager. And mm-hmm. so with the teenager, you've known by experience that it actually helps to let the anger, you know, run its course, go full force, and that they're aware of the anger. And mm-hmm. then it's like, okay, so what's it for you? So, mm-hmm. so how do you bring the what's in for you? What is it? You prepare people a little bit to the experience of focusing. How do you introduce that ability to be able to notice what's there for you?
First, for example, with teenagers, there must be a little bit of trust. So I've usually worked in NGOs where I get to know them and they get to know me, and they see that I work different, and also the educators were different from, for example, from the teachers or from the parents. So they also have that background of, this is a safe place. This is a place where I'm cared for. People care. Do I matter? The big question, do I matter to you? And when they see that, yes, you do matter to me. Yes, I care about you. I see your anger, and I'm not angry at your anger. I'm curious.
Yeah.
So I sometimes say that, oh, never use the word curious. Sometimes when I give trainings, people go and say curious to teenagers, and they get really upset. But I get curious and I say, oh, so you're angry and let me understand. Of course, you have all the right to be angry. And how is it for you to be so angry? So the validation of the anger doesn't add up more tension. It's more like, let's explore it. You don't have to fight with me. Please do not fight with the other guy with whom you want to fist fight, for example. Just let's be here. Can we go outside? Can we talk about this? And please be sure that I want something that works for you. That is the other part, because sometimes in mediation, some mediation programs or so-called mediation programs are just like, let's get everybody to lose a little bit. And there are lots of programs that work on the contrary on a win-win situation. So there's also that message. I'm not going to cause you harm. I want you to win in this situation and I want us all to win. But first I need to understand what would be winning for you. Sometimes when it is a fight among teenagers, it is usually has to do with respect, having their place, belonging, being seen, being accepted as they are, being accepted as different, has to do with being seen in the group. So when we can translate that into something that is acceptable by the group usually says, okay, okay, we see, yes, you're right, you said that and you were right. So we reweave the fabric of the community because we have that awareness that we do not want to cause harm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try and say it in a slightly different way to see if I got you right. Mm-hmm. And I think first the point about validating the anger is not in any possible way some kind of pandering or something where you are pretending something you're not believing, because you fully understand that the anger makes sense as a reaction to the situation as experienced by this person. So
we know from focusing that whatever appears, even if anger is just an emotion, if we stay long with it, it can become a felt sense. So it is welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really definitely that sense of deeply understanding, appreciating, not just tolerating, but understanding, that it's there and validating it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what I find striking in what you're describing for the teenager is, in a way, taking the place of the more evolved structures of the brain or the more, of being able to understand what they really want to do in order to find a better way to do it that actually works within the society they're in.
That's what we do. When with children and even with teenagers and even with other people, we lend them our, speaking neurologically, our prefrontal cortex. And there's also this saying in neurobiology that the amygdala, the calmer amygdala, can soothe the another amygdala that is very activated. That happens. And that happens to me also when I'm very upset. I go to somebody to get listened to, and then I can see things in a different way. So it is not patronizing. It's just at certain moments, our brain works in a certain way, and we need somebody else to borrow from them a little bit of their prefrontal cortex.
And you first have to connect to the amygdala, and as you say very nicely, the cooler amygdala to the, heated up amygdala, so that there is the connection. And then once the connection is there, then the prefrontal cortex can be brought in. The auxiliary prefrontal cortex can be brought in.
And calming the amygdala has a lot to do with being present. for me, all that I've learned from focusing, and when I'm teaching focusing or focusing attitudes in workshops, the importance is giving that presence, giving that safety. The amygdala has to do with not safe. And we switch it back to normal by giving it safety.
And so that sense of you've described the process and the importance of safety, maybe we can come back to the other example you were mentioning before about the husband who is beating his wife. And as you said, it's not something that just happens. He just wakes up and says, oh, I'm going to do that today. But it's a long history, a lot of pressures, a lot of frustrations. And so you come in with a sense of more empathy for how it may have happened. But so how do you actually connect in that case?
That is much more difficult. I'm used to working with teenagers who have started but not gone deeply into that. I'm much more used to working with victims of violence. And it is because of that that I appreciate very much people who, psychologists and psychotherapists, that work with people who offend. I don't want to label people, but they are usually called offenders. I prefer to call them people who have done that. There's a core truth that it has been a long process. It has been a very harming process. And the person who has caused that harm first has to acknowledge it. And sometimes we find that these people have precisely unacknowledged pain in their childhood. That doesn't take out any of their responsibility as adults. Not at all. They're still responsible. But the way that I see that works better is making them look at their childhood. They usually have very schematic ways of looking at their childhood, very rigid, like my parents did this and it was bad, or it was good, and it is always like this. And they cannot acknowledge the pain they felt themselves, so when they cause harm, they cannot acknowledge it. And that is the problem. And there's a lot of manipulation. I don't want to take that out. And also there is, I mean, sometimes it is very pathological. And the problem is I'm more used to working with victims. The problem is when you look at the victim, and the victim is still attached to that person.
Right. So you cannot separate the two. And so it's about how do you deal with the situation as a whole.
And there is when you bring a second concept that here we are just giving very swiftly. The second concept has to do with power. Violence happens in a context of power. Power because you love somebody and then they have power over you. Power because somebody has an authority, you trust them with authority, or the society has given them the authority, or somebody has power because there's a difference, usually physical, in strength, or in money, or social. So, for example, in gender-based violence, the problem is that there has been a way of making that love and power be related, so the woman feels really loved. One of the first things we learn not to do with women who have suffered gender-based violence is that he doesn't love you. No, yes, he does love me, they tell us. We need to make them see that, yes, he loves them in a harmful way. Mm-hmm. So we need to, another useful concept is joining, making go together, love and care. Sometimes they're separated, but it is better they go together. So when we love somebody, we better love somebody who cares about us. And if we love somebody, we better care about them. And if we love somebody and they don't care about us, the healthy situation, the healthy process would be to slowly letting it go, or drastically, whatever it goes. But I mean, the inner process is letting go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This with adults takes a long, long time. With children and their parents, I work in child protection and children who have been abused and molested by their parents or by family friends or by their siblings. That is very hard because there's a lot of affection, there's attachment, there's safety issues. Who's going to take care of me? I prefer being taken care badly by this person than not being taken care of at all.
Yeah.
So there's another element there that is care. How do I feel in my body when I'm taken care of? How do I feel in my body when I care about somebody else? And how can I see the differences in my relationships?
Yeah. So this is actually, you know, as we talk about it, profoundly moving. Because essentially this is the picture of somebody who cannot know the difference. You know, say a child who's raised in a violent environment. Because essentially the caring is merged with the violence. And it's hard to separate both, because getting rid of the violence would also be getting rid of the caring. And it's hard to get to see that there can be daylight between both of them, that you can have caring without violence. And it's not in a way just having an abstract concept, writing a beautiful essay on the fact that it can be done differently. But it's actually the life conditions of this child. And is there an alternative? Is there a way that the situation can change so that it's not just an empty promise?
Yes, and there we can go into something that I work in a consultancy firm, Espirales Consultoría de Infancia. It is based here in Spain, but we work internationally, and we are providing assessment to several international organizations about how to provide childcare that really serves the development of the child. And one of the very important things is, I want to say it briefly because this would be a whole other topic, but when you receive a child in child protection, in childcare, you need to give them at least four things to have resilience. This concept of of overcoming the pain, the harm, and becoming a full person without forgetting, without leaving behind, just processing what was there. The first one is safety. The child protection settings should be absolutely safe. And that is very difficult to convey. There are things that we can do. And the first thing is asking children, what would make this place safer for you? Like smaller chairs, or painting in the walls, or having a picture of my parents, or choosing this and that. Second, that is very important, is affection. Expressing a healthy affection is necessary. They need new models. And third, they need acceptance. See, the difference between affection is expressing I'm happy and I'm happy of being about being here with you. I'm sad with your sadness. I can see that you are sad and I can be with you with your sadness. And that is kind of mixing both of them. But acceptance means you are whatever you are and it is okay. And you can be like that as long as you need it. We're going to do things to make you safe. So we don't want aggressions here. So we're going to make it easier for you not to be aggressive. We're going to be making it easier to you to express your anger or your sadness. So the acceptance has to do with that wholeness. And the fourth element, and this is so little understood, is the body. We are mammals. We are animals. And when we are young, a lot of what happens through our body. So when we work in child protection, we want to dance with children, play physically, not just playing chess. Also chess, but physically, running with them, kind of doing all those corporal things, all those things with the body that can make them feel inside. Because sometimes they come like completely protected. They have like an armor. They come completely armored against the outside and they need to move.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So these four elements are very important in child protection.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's very powerful to, for all the deep respect we have for what focusing does, to see that actually focusing doesn't happen in a vacuum, but mm-hmm. it's part of that larger context, which allows for the blossoming of what focusing can do. And without which, it might not actually be possible for it to work. It's not a miracle tool, a magical tool, but something mm-hmm. that's integrated in that deeper vision of all that mm-hmm. is necessary to go from trauma to resilience.
Of course. And there is, when in the trainings, we need to make people experience this first in their own childhoods, process them, find their place to process them, if there is a lot about, if there is too much to process in just a workshop, and empower them to start feeling mm-hmm. from the inside. Because sometimes when we react to children, it is our inner child that is reacting. When we react to a teenager, it is sometimes our own inner teenager who is reacting. So there's a work there, and focusing is a perfect tool for me to convey that way of, wait a moment, before, so in a training we sometimes go like, we want to do that, and people start to say, yes, I always want to work with what they are already doing, because when we work with professionals, most of them are doing a wonderful work, but they're doing it unconsciously. So someday they come very upset, and this child they've been taking care of for 2 weeks, newly arrived, does something and they cannot deal with it. Why? They don't know. It is not conscious. So focusing gives us a handle, gives them a handle for their own inner processes, to say, I'm getting here upset. I need to listen to myself before listening to this kid. Or I'm not going to be able to deal with it alone. I need somebody else. I call another educator. Or in this, I think I need to get more data. or more time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask for a recess, mm-hmm. or I'm going to go to the bathroom or something like that. So we try to empower because people already know a lot of the things, but they're not conscious.
Yeah.
And with focusing processes, they start also to name, as Jen would say, they start to create their own theory of their own way of intervening mm-hmm. in these situations. And that is the most precious result, because when we work in a team, when I work with a team, it is very clearly that somebody's the joker, jokes a lot, and somebody's the silent one, and somebody is very active, and somebody is very, like, gives a lot of structure. And everybody has their own way. And sometimes I see it when, for example, when training young professionals, it is like, we all want to be the joker. And it's like, it's not going to work. It's going to work for those of you who are really funny. For the rest of you, it is going to be like, look at the faces of the children when you said that joke. It is like, oh no, they're pretending to be funny. So just find your own way.
Right,
and focusing
right.
gives us that way of embodying and slowly finding our own inner theory about how we intervene.
Yeah. And so in that also, it's a liberation from pressures, a blossoming of being who you are. That's a parallel process with the healing process and that we do as healing professionals. Want to check if that's a right place for you to end here, or if there's something you might want to add as a conclusion?
Yes, that's 2 points. One first point, when you said that final sentence about and we change and that would be the healing process. The healing process doesn't stop there, because when we start working in professional settings like these, we see that structures need to change.
Mm-hmm.
And then focusing comes again, and then we have to build really solid theories to explain why we want to do this with children, why we want to change this with children, why we want to change timetables with children, why we want to change only the psychologist is the child alone. All these things are going to need a different structure that is going to emerge, that is going to be specific for each team, and that needs a lot of more thinking at the edge than, but also a focusing presence. And the second point, just to end this, is has to do with hope. Understanding that violence is not about being a bad person, that we are all violent in some moments, that we are not powerless about violence, that we can name it, we can find our own handles, inner handles in our bodies to identify violence when we are violent or when we suffer violence, but also external handles to talk about why this is social violence, why this is ecological violence, why this is interpersonal violence, why this is domestic violence.
Yeah.
So we are empowered, and then we can heal. And it always is going to go through the body.
Thank you, Javier.
Thank you, Serge.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at
focusing.org/conversations.